from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. America is short on doctors. The American Association of Medical Colleges puts the doctor shortfall at 130,000 by the year 2025. The irony is that there are doctors ready and willing to help fill the void, but they're stuck in the waiting room. They're mostly foreign-born doctors who've been trained abroad, and they can't practice here until they go through a rigorous screening program that can take close to a decade. Is that the right approach, or should we re-examine what it takes to be in the exam room? The licensing of foreign-trained doctors, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In Washington, D.C., House Republicans are once again intent on defunding the Obamacare Act, but around the country, a much less publicized healthcare drama is beginning to play out. Regardless of what happens in Washington, we don't have enough licensed doctors to go around. And the key word in that last sentence is licensed. There are actually thousands of doctors trained abroad, mostly foreign-born, who could perhaps help solve that shortage problem, but can't until they go through an extensive screening, exam, and training and residency process that can take many years. So are those rigorous licensing requirements appropriate? Or should we make it easier for foreign-trained doctors to pick up a stethoscope and help solve the problem of the shortage in this country? Joining us this hour to talk about that, Dr. Jose Ramon Fernandez-Pena. He's an associate professor in the Department of Health Education at San Francisco State University and director of the Welcome Back Initiative, which is an international assistance center to help in this regard. Dr. Fernandez-Pena, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Joining us as well is Atul Grover, who is the chief of public policy officer for the Association of American Medical Colleges, which has been focusing attention on the problem of the physician shortage in this country. Atul Grover, thanks for being with us as well.
My pleasure.
And Bill Kelly joins us too. He's the acting vice president for operations of the Educational Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates, which is the institution which begins the reviewing process by assessing the transcripts and background of foreign-trained physicians who seek licensing in this country. Bill Kelly, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you. Good morning.
So let's begin by talking about what this population could help solve and talk about the problem of the physician shortage itself. Atul Grover, get us started on that. What are we looking at right now in terms of the number of doctors we need, especially if the Affordable Care Act, in fact, goes into actuality?
Well, the challenge that we have right now is actually not having enough physicians to even care for the population that's insured and lives in the U.S. We're already at least 10,000 physicians short in terms of being able to care for the populations we have. And we expect that that shortage of physicians will grow to about 125,000 within the next 12 years. And I would say that the key word there is not really licensed. It's the problem with residencies, that since 1997, we haven't been able to keep up in training enough doctors once they either go to medical school here or in another country.
And that bottleneck at the residency stage, that applies to whether or not you're a medical student in this country, or are you specifically talking about that being the bottleneck for those who have gone to medical school abroad?
No, it's a bottleneck for physicians regardless of where they went to medical school. In 1997, Congress created this problem by freezing support for physician training. And we know that the population has grown 50 million since then. We're about to put another 30 million people into the health insurance world. And we know that our population is aging and growing bigger by the day.
And what difference, Atul Grover, could those who have received their medical training abroad make in putting a dent in that shortage?
Well, every year we have a number of physicians that were educated abroad actually enter U.S. residency training positions, as well as U.S. citizens that went to medical school abroad. And so at any given time, there's likely 5,000, 6,000 internationally trained physicians that apply to get their training in the U.S. So if we had enough training positions for them, they could certainly help address the shortages.
Dr. Fernandez-Pena here at San Francisco State, do you see it the same way, that residency is the heart of the problem, that that's what we need to change, not only for those physicians who are coming from abroad, but also here in this country?
Absolutely. The bottleneck has been that challenge of getting a residency training spot. Every year, I don't have the exact numbers with me, but there's at least three times as many applicants as there are slots available.
And paint a picture, if you would, of the kinds of physicians who have been trained abroad, who, if they could get through the bottleneck, could provide service to this country. What are their skills? What are their talents? What is going unused?
So many things. The Welcome Back Initiative works only with individuals who already live in the United States. So they have already been trained. The vast majority of them have already completed a residency training in their country of origin, and they have years of experience in the particular field of expertise. In addition to that, they bring, because of the fact that they are foreign-born and trained, most of them, they bring language and culture, which the health sector is in dire need right now. For example, in California, where 36% of the population is Latino, only about 4% of physicians are Latino. So when we combine the lack of raw numbers of providers with the lack of cultural and linguistic diversity in the health workforce, you have a double whammy that comes out as a series of health disparities.
And Bill Kelly at the Educational Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates, you're the sort of first gatekeeper in this process in terms of evaluating the kind of training that people have. In your judgment, is that gatekeeping function, and I know you don't deal with residencies per se, but are we being too rigid and rigorous? Are we requiring too much of people who have received this training from abroad?
Well, one of our primary objectives is to protect the public, and the standards for ECFMG certification were established specifically with that in mind. International medical graduates are required to pass the same examinations that students enrolled in U.S. medical, students and graduates of U.S. medical schools pass. They also must have a medical degree from a recognized medical school abroad, and we must primary source verify that degree. But as Dr. Fernandez-Pena indicated, ECFMG historically over the last...
And again, that's the commission, just to cut through on the initials for a moment, that's the Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates. Sorry, go ahead.
The ECFMG, yeah. And we certify, that is, we approximately 9,000 to 10,000 international medical graduates every year meet our requirements and get our certificate.
So that gets you sort of through the door, but then people have to pass the same board exams, is that correct? And then also serve a residency, even if they've already been a practicing physician for any number of years elsewhere?
Yeah, in the United States, there's a medical licensing exam for MDs called the United States Medical Licensing Examination, and there are three steps to it. For international medical graduates, they must pass step one and step two to meet the exam requirements for the ECFMG certificate, that and plus, you know, completion of their medical education abroad and the verification of that education. And the ECFMG certificate then makes them eligible to start a residency program in the United States. And it's after they graduate, and normally after they've started the residency program, that they will take the step three, the third step of the licensing examination. And most states require completion for an international medical graduate of not only all the USMLE steps, but 2 to 3 years of residency training to get a license.
And I guess what I'd like to get to, Atul Grover, is how much of this is necessary. As Bill Kelly suggests, I mean, as a bare minimum, of course, we would want to ensure that doctors who have been trained abroad meet the standards that we would like to see met here in this country. But is it necessary to pass the board exams and have an additional 3-year residency to ensure that quality?
I think if you think about it from the public's perspective and from even our perspectives as patients, you want some assurance that the physician that's going to care for you has adequate training and has really shown that they can practice independently. And while we know that there are excellent physicians who might come from abroad who have trained and practiced for a number of years that might not need all of that, it's very difficult to assure the public because we can't have thousands of health professionals going abroad trying to verify quality of residency training programs in every nation in the world. And so we have decided, I think, as states and as a nation, that we want to be sure that everybody has appropriate training in the U.S. medical system before we allow them to go out and practice independently.
But it's not done that way everywhere, Dr. Fernandez-Pena, is it? I mean, in Canada, for example, and some other countries, there's which would seem to have a model for the delivery of health care that's not inferior to ours. The steps are not quite as arduous.
They are different, and the ECFMG does an amazing job in ensuring that people have the necessary training and that their credentials are valid. So I think it's important that we have a set of standards. I completely agree with that. But as you point out, for example, in Canada, a physician that comes from a group of countries that the Canadians have determined to be that provide an equal education to theirs, they may just need to do a year, especially in family practice, for example, under supervision before they can get a license to practice as such. So perhaps the question that it's in my mind is, we're asking a well-trained, well-rounded practicing physician to take the exams somebody who just finished medical school takes to determine their competency. I wonder if we were to take the same standard and we got a well-trained American cardiologist who's been in practice for 15 years to take the same exams, they may not do as well because they are so focused on their specialty. But still, there are opportunities to look at what other countries are doing and see if we can learn anything from that.
Let's welcome into our conversation now a physician who has tried to work through this process. She is Nadia Faludian, who is trained as a physician from Iran, but has run into these very requirements that we've been discussing. Dr. Faludian, thank you for being part of our conversation this morning.
That's my pleasure.
And you have so far been unable to complete these requirements to begin a practice here in this country. First, if you would tell us about your training in Iran and the years of experience that you had.
Well, I was born and went to the medical school in Iran in the medical school that's named Shiraz University of Medical Science. That is a well-known university in Iran among the five top universities in medical schools. And then after that, I practiced medicine as a general practitioner for more than 7 years. And then I came to the U.S. and passed the USMLE exams in the first 2 years. And then after that, I'm applying each year consecutively. And I applied for 4 years, and I couldn't get any position in residency.
So for you, it's that the bottleneck is residency. That's where you've gotten stuck in the process?
That's right.
And so what have you been doing? You've been in this country. You have these qualifications. You've passed certain exams. What have you been able to do?
Well, in fact, nothing. Because, you know, it's getting harder and harder each year. After passing the exams and even before finishing them, I started to go to the hospitals for volunteering, different kind of observerships. And as you know, it's very time-consuming, and sometimes I even had to pay for them. But I couldn't get any kind of job with my even ECFMG certificate because it means nothing here in the U.S. besides enables you to apply for a residency. But even you cannot get a simple job with that because nobody knows what is an ECFMG certificate. So I have no identity here. You know, I cannot work any healthcare field.
When you hear Dr. Faludian's story, Jose Ramon Fernandez Pena, what does that make you think about in terms of, I guess, the talent that we're kind of leaving out of the exam room?
It sadly reminds me of the stories of the 13,000 people we have served in the program. So what we try to do when we encounter individuals like Nadia is...
This is the Welcome Back program at...
Correct, the Welcome Back Initiative at San Francisco State and City College of San Francisco. It's a joint program. We work with them to understand where they came from, who they were, who they are, and who they want to be. And then, along with the participants, we prepare a pathway to guide them to where they may want to go once they ascertain their options. Is it going to happen for me, depending on where I am? What are my needs? What are my priorities right now? If I have two jobs, do I have time to prepare for the exams? If I have a family to support, is it better to stay where I am? So we try to expose them to options and alternatives. While the shortage of physicians is going to be very critical, also the shortage of workforce in the public health field is even more critical. We expect 250,000 public health workers needed by 2020, for example. And many of our participants can pursue options either while they go for their final goal, but at least they're working or trying to work within the field they know and love and bring to it, again, their language, their culture, their passion. And they can capitalize on some of the skills they may already have, either in the public health workforce or in the allied health workforce.
Dr. Faludian, stay with us as we continue our conversation, because you raised such an interesting example of someone who would seemingly have talents that would be of great help as this country, Atul Grover, expands if the Affordable Care Act, in fact, goes into effect, the number of people who will be needing medical care. And also as the country becomes that much more diverse, it would seem like there would be this kind of logical pairing up of the people, the very people who will now be able to afford health care, with people who could provide that care. So it seems, at least on the surface, Atul Grover, that we're missing a kind of obvious solution to a problem that we have.
We are, and that the solution really revolves around creating more residency training positions so that we can utilize the wonderful human resources that are exhibited by people like Dr. Faludian. And just this year alone, there were almost 4,000 international medical graduates who didn't match into a residency program. There were over 500 U.S. MDs that graduated from medical school and couldn't get into a residency training program. And we are going to have shortages across the board, certainly in primary care and with frontline workers. But also, if you think about the demographics of our population, we're going to have a need for more oncologists and surgeons and pediatric specialists. So this is a really looming crisis that Congress could easily fix, but unfortunately, they haven't been willing to do that.
You know, it's so ironic to be having this conversation on the very day that another debate is playing out in Washington over funding or defunding Obamacare. And it makes me wonder, and I'd like to hear from each of you on this, whether we've got our eyes on the prize or not. I mean, whether or not we're focused on the right problem. Atul Grover?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have been very supportive of expanding care to as many patients as possible by extending them health insurance. But you need health workers to actually care for those patients, and it's physicians, it's nurses, it's public health, it's social workers, and we just have not been willing to invest in a workforce to care for a population in which 10,000 people turn 65 every day, and that'll continue to happen for the next 20 years.
Bill Kelly, are we just not looking at what the real problem is here?
Well, first of all, you know, in talking about the role of the international medical graduate in the U.S. healthcare system, remember that approximately one out of every four licensed
right.
physicians in the United States currently is an international medical graduate. Also, approximately 25% of the physicians already in residency training is an international medical graduate. As I indicated before, every year, there are a significant number more of international medical graduates who meet the rigorous ECFMG standards for ECFMG certification and to whom we issue ECFMG certificates than can get into a residency program. So there's a huge resource there.
And Dr. Fernandez-Pena, I mean, are we, again, I guess I want to drill down on this a bit later, a bit more, because it's so striking to be talking about this while we're reading about the votes that are going on in Washington. What do we need to do? I mean, where should we focus our attention? If the basic question is, how are we going to provide more care to more people in this country? Where do we go?
There's so many places to go, and the two other gentlemen on the call have just cited examples of why it's so critical to expand the number of residency training programs. But I want to go beyond that, because even if I had a magic wand right now and I was able to relicense the 13 people we've seen at Welcome Back, we would still have thousands and thousands of shortages across the country, across specialties, across areas of health. So for me, the larger question behind all this is, willing to accept the talent that we already have in the United States? What about immigrant professional integration as a larger concept, where we don't only talk about dentists and pharmacists, but we also talk about accountants and lawyers and engineers who are already here? Again, my focus is on people who are already part of the United States but cannot fully exercise their profession, their identity, they cannot become fully functional members of society and contribute the way they can. So we are negating that opportunity.
Dr. Faludian, what would you like to do? What would you like your day to be today that it is not?
Well, of course, I like to be a physician. That has been my identity, you know, that is my character, part of my personality. But if I cannot do that, so, for example, as everybody says, the first solution is to increasing the number of the residency position. That it seems that there is no reasonable logic to prevent that. But after that, there is many other ways. For example, when I came here into the United States 6 years ago, I was practicing to the week before that in Iran. And I was completely ready to practice here, maybe not as a physician, but I could do that as a physician assistant completely, confidently. So if there was, for example, a program that could accept me and train me, for example, for 1 year, I was completely ready in any aspect, in my language, in everything, that confidently practice as a physician assistant, or, for example, if there was, or even you consider me or any other ECFMG certified people here as a study for the USMLE exams at least for 1 year, and most of them for 2 years, to become licensed as an ECFMG certified.
So let me hold you there, because we're about to go to a break. But if I understand this then correctly, Dr. Fernandez-Pena, someone like Dr. Faludian, who is a physician, has been a physician for any number of years in Iran, can't even be a physician's assistant in this country at this point? I mean, so there are obstacles even at that level as well?
Correct. The Physician Assistant Association is very clear on the fact that they will only grant licenses to people who go through the entire physician assistant program, and that may require 1 or 2 years of prerequisites. So that would be a 4-year plan. In other words, her training as a physician would not count towards anything.
Fascinating. We'll come back in just a moment and pick up on this topic. We'd like to invite you to participate in our conversation. What do you think about this issue? Is there a need to open the doors wider, perhaps, to those who have received their medical training abroad? Would you be open to that the next time you go see a doctor? Or do you have concerns about seeing a doctor whose training was abroad? After all, 1 in 4 doctors already received that training abroad, but is that something that you would welcome, or was that something that you would give you some pause? We'd like to talk about that when we return. 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour: how we might be able to take more advantage of those physicians who have been trained abroad but are as yet not able to practice in this country. it's an interesting question in part because we're already short on physicians in the United States, and that number will continue to grow. According to the Association of American Medical Colleges, we will need 60,000 doctors. We'll be 60,000 doctors short by 2015, 130,000 doctors short 10 years after that. Can those doctors who have been trained abroad help fill that gap? What do we need to do to make that possible? Or is it important to make it hard for that to take place because we want to maintain certain standards in this country? That's some of what we want to get into during this next part of our program. 866-733-6786 is the number if you'd like to join in our conversation. Let's hear from Jennifer first, who joins us from San Ramon. Jennifer.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. First thing I just want to say is that as an ESL teacher, I have the opportunity of helping an immigrant from Afghanistan do some research, and he was able to get into a physician's assistant program at UC Davis, completed it in 2 years and is now practicing. He's very happy to, you know, give the information. I think that's probably one problem that I'm hearing about. Second comment is I've had a chronic health condition since 1967. I've lived abroad. I've seen doctors all my life as a child growing up. And the knowledge base in different parts of the world is not the same as what we have here in the United States. Now, as a consumer of health, let's just say asthma, diabetes, I would want to have a doctor who is licensed here in the United States.
Jennifer, thank you. And I think everyone acknowledges the importance of making sure someone has been trained appropriately and has the right certifications. But I'd be interested to hear more from our listeners on that. Is there hesitation in some ways about seeing doctors and uncertainty about what some of those qualifications might be? Jennifer, thanks for getting us started in this part of our program. Let's hear next from Joe in Concord. Joe, go ahead.
Hi. I'm a mixed Hispanic European guy, so you know, I'm here in the Bay Area. My primary care physician was born in Egypt. The nurse I see all the time is African American. My dentist was born in Korea. My pharmacist is from the Philippines. I don't have a problem with people who aren't Latino being my doctor, and I really want to take your guest that made that statement. That was ridiculous and racist, that Latino Californians need Latino doctors. That's inexcusable. We're a melting pot society. We're Americans. Doesn't matter where we come from. We're Americans. And when people come in and assimilate and they get their license so that they can work here, it doesn't matter where they're from. They're providing a quality of care that we need.
Joe, thank you. Thanks for being so passionate in expressing your views. Dr. Fernandez-Pena, you want to respond? I believe you're making the point that many of the people who will be included in their healthcare needs, if the Affordable Care Act goes through, are of Latino descent, and that only 5% of the doctors in this state are of that, and that you think there is a need for more of a match.
Correct. In California, it's estimated that about 1.4 million people will have access to health services after the full implementation of the Affordable Care Act, and approximately 35% of those do not speak English as their first language at home. So when we are able to provide services with an understanding of the culture and sometimes with the use of the language, we are more effective to provide services to those who cannot communicate with their providers in English. That was the point.
What about Joe's? You heard his passion about this is a melting pot. He sees a pharmacist of one ethnicity, a nurse of another, a doctor of another, and that's sort of, you know, the old American ideal.
I think it's a very valid point, and I think it's also important to recognize that when a provider of health services has in his or her little bag another language and additional tools to provide services to those who may not command the language is a very important thing. And also granted that everybody who is licensed to do anything in this country, certainly in California, needs to take the exams in English. So we're all for the achievement of commanding the English language.
Carlos in San Francisco, you're on. Go ahead, Carlos.
Yes, I have two to your question/comment. I mean, one, do you guys
think that this reflects maybe the lack of these doctors being supported and let in the system. Do you think it maybe reflects a larger problem with xenophobia, perhaps even a little racism there, that people say, well, if they were born in the United States, the doctors automatically have to be better? Because me personally, I was born here, but my parents immigrated from El Salvador, but I feel a little more comfortable with doctors from Latin America because they understand my culture a little more. We share experiences, so to speak, as a culture. But I've had Iranian doctors, I had Korean doctors and dentists and what have you. So I really don't focus on the country, but I'm kind of learning that most people aren't like that. They kind of do kind of focus on the country, except for the caller from before. Do you guys have any ideas on that?
Carlos, thank you. Dr. Fernandez-Pena again on that question, the degree to which this inevitably gets us into yet another controversial issue, which is, of course, immigration reform.
Well, indeed, and we have a sweet opportunity there at the intersection of immigration reform and health reform, where we could look at folks who are here and are in the process of trying to regularize the status due to the fact that they have higher degrees of education, put them further up on the line. That's one question that one would ask. But I think the important point, again, is when a provider of health services can use their cultural and linguistic competency to provide better services, the whole system is richer and better.
William in Belvedere is joining us next. William.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm a now retired internist, and so my experience with medicine, practicing it, goes back to the 60s. Back then, there were great impediments put to foreign physicians coming to and getting licensed to practice in the United States. And at that time, I think it was very clear that, to some degree, it was the then-licensed physicians, U.S. physicians, who were creating barriers that were unnecessary, but simply protecting what you might describe as their franchise. I would appreciate knowing to what extent the guests may feel that those modalities are still being employed. And also, what has happened in Europe in terms of the European Union and whether now doctors can practice in any country within the European Union, and I assume they couldn't before, and to what extent that may have affected the quality and the supply of physicians.
William, thank you. Great questions. Atul Grover, back to you. First on the franchise question, it's a very logical question to ask, that part of this is whether it's physicians or in any occupation, there's always a kind of self-protective instinct. You want to protect your franchise. Do you think that's some of what's going on?
I don't think people are actually out to protect their franchise at all in medicine. What we hear from physicians all over the country and in every specialty is that we have an urgent need to train more doctors, and they're worried about getting people to come in and help them in their practices and take call with them. They really do think that this is an issue that needs to be addressed by expanding residency training. The other thing that I'll also just mention is from an educational perspective, we see great value in having physicians and students that come from varied backgrounds, not only for cultural competency for the patients that they themselves are going to see, but also because by having a diverse workforce, we learn from our colleagues in the health professions about what it's like to be from another culture. So we think that's very important for medicine in general.
Just staying on this franchise question for a moment, we heard Dr. Fuladian make the observation before that she's a trained physician, yet she couldn't get even to be a physician's assistant unless she basically went back to school. Do you see that as a concern, Dr. Fernandez-Pena, that there is a protective instinct, whether that's within the physician's assistants group or any other health profession, that they really don't want the competition?
I think that there's been a very clear concern from the physician assistant associations as to whether a foreign-trained doctor could go through an accelerated program, for example, which the logic of which escapes me, because if they learn anatomy and physiology in Iran or in Stanford, probably it's the exact same bone in the exact same place. A similar situation occurs, for example, with dentists who may not as easily become licensed dentists in the U.S. without going through a two-year program that is extremely expensive. They may not even go, except in Florida, I think, for a dental hygienist program or license without going through a number of years of training, regardless of the fact that they may have at least a 50% of the education already under their belts.
So a foreign-trained dentist could not be a dental hygienist in this country unless they went back to school for
Correct.
2 years?
Except there's a program in Florida that allows that.
Fascinating. Back to our calls. We'll go next to Joe in Sacramento. Joe.
Great show. I've just been in the Medi-Cal program, unfortunately, for the last 6 years with a chronic condition, and I haven't had any Western European physician in that time, and no native English-speaking physician. I just want to say that my experience has been that when I talk with my physicians, and I've changed, but very limited selection, they actually take offense when I'm trying to talk about my condition because I can see that they're not following.
Mm.
They're just not following what I'm talking about. And it's usually the construction of the sentences, they learn English, but they learn it sort of like the Japanese learn English in a technical sense. But they don't learn the intricacies of the prepositional phrases, usually. And that's where the meaning gets lost. They don't understand the difference of into and onto, or in and on, or just how the...
It's a great point, Joe. Thank you. How do you work with in your program on that specific issue? Joe's raising a really interesting point, which is that sometimes there is an art to medicine, right? It's not just a science. And part
Absolutely.
Of the art is in really sensing and perceiving what it is the person in front of you is bringing to the exam room. And if you aren't able to process that linguistically, how can you really provide the care that someone like Joe needs?
Absolutely. Medicine is, in fact, the art and the science of preventing disease and restoring health. One of the things we did early on with the Welcome Back initiative was develop an accelerated health-focused English as a second language curriculum that we offer at City College of San Francisco. And even though that program may not get to the ultimate subtleties of interpersonal communication, we recognized early on that without that basic tool of language, the English language, our participants are not going to be able to go ahead. Once we allow them or enable them to get opportunities in the workplace and begin to gain experience, they are able to practice that interpersonal communication better.
Joe, thanks so much for your call. You raised really interesting points for us to all consider. Some comments coming in from Facebook. Cristalli writes, if language is not an issue for foreign-trained doctors or, like me, physical therapists, they should get licensed faster. We've worked on people. We know what to do. We're not beginners. We're just in a new society. Hani writes, I am what you may call a foreign medical graduate from medical school, but with no additional training. I completed my residency here in California, and I'm practicing now. The certification is, I agree, rigorous, but I feel that's a good method of standardization of the process, or else there would not be a way to know who comes from what level of training. I feel like maybe there could be an expedited track and a way to accredit physicians with higher degrees and who have had several years of experience. That might help a little. It's an interesting thought, Bill Kelly, about is there a way to fast track so that you could sort of more quickly kind of put people through the process if they have gone through a certain level of training, or if they've been, as Dr. Fernandez-Pena was suggesting earlier, perhaps from a particular country that whose standards we know is analogous to ours?
Well, with respect to medical licensure, as was stated before, very rarely would a state medical licensing board in the United States give credit, at least currently, to any postgraduate residency fellowship training that the physician had done in his or her own country. And that's the current system now. So in a sense, there is no fast track. And in fact, most state medical boards in the United States may require more years of residency training for an international medical graduate than they do of a U.S. medical graduate currently.
Atul Grover, you want to chime in on that, on this? Because I want to come back to the point that was made earlier about, Canada, I guess, has a system where if you've had your training from certain countries, I don't know whether that's Japan, Britain, wherever, you can sort of go through this on a faster track. Wouldn't that make some sense?
Well, I think in some sense, you can do that, because to get licensed, you may require only, two or three years of residency training. The bigger challenge comes in when you've got lots of specialty certification boards that will ensure that a physician is, say, qualified to practice internal medicine or general surgery or psychiatry. And so those things become more and more complicated as you have these other certifying bodies involved. What I would say, though, is, again, you can speed things up by getting people into a residency that are foreign medical graduates, because they are immediately not only receiving training, but they're seeing patients under the supervision of attending physicians. And so it really is a win-win for everyone if we could just get those positions created.
Dr. Fernandez-Pena?
Yes, just to underscore the point that the work that the ECFMG does is national, and it's a fabulous standard to have in place. But then we have each state has its own licensing boards. So this is not a national solution. It has to be a state-by-state solution.
And to Calvin in Danville. Calvin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Basically, I wanted to say that they did the same thing with law school back in the 80s, where they were saying that there weren't enough law graduates to fulfill this needed demand. And now we have a glut of law graduates in the field now who can't find jobs. And I think a lot of the population data is often overestimated when it comes to growth. And I think that if you talk to a lot of physicians that are working now, they would say that the real problem is in rural areas and maybe some inner city areas where they have the shortage. But other than that, there isn't really a shortage. So.
Yeah. Interesting, Calvin. There is a debate about this, Atul Grover, about what the extent of the shortage really is, or whether or not it's really a zip code problem.
Yeah, I think it's both. It's not only that we don't have enough physicians to serve everyone in every community. It's also that some communities are notoriously hard to attract and retain physicians to for a variety of reasons. And the challenge is, as we move forward and the shortages that we believe will get worse, it'll actually be even worse for those places that are already underserved, inner city areas, rural areas. And I think the most vulnerable people are the ones that are going to suffer as access to a physician becomes more difficult.
Calvin, thanks. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Emily in San Mateo. Emily.
Hi. I'm Emily, and I'm from San Mateo. Thanks for taking my call. I really strongly believe that foreign-trained doctors, when they arrive in the United States, that they should be relicensed, retrained. And aside from the linguistic and the interpersonal issues that were discussed, I think they need to be retrained for several reasons. And I'll give you a very specific example. I was born in Vietnam. I've lived in the United States, and I'm an ESL teacher, so I am not against foreign-born doctors at all, or their accent. I'm very used to it. But let's take a foreign-trained doctor from Vietnam, and he comes here and he wants to practice. And he, before he can practice, he needs to be retrained and relicensed, because what he learned in terms of technology and equipment that they used in Vietnamese hospital, even in the top Vietnamese hospitals in Saigon and Hanoi, it's nothing compared to what we have here. So they need to learn the technology part of medicine. And then another thing is what they learned in medical school in Vietnam, medical textbooks are written in in English. And so they have to, and those books are outdated. And there are so many new innovations and medicines or issues that come up in medicine that they didn't learn about or didn't know about when they were, you know, in Vietnam or in medical school that is relevant here.
Let me hold you there, Emily. You've raised a really useful and interesting point, especially given your own background as an immigrant from Vietnam. Dr. Fernandez-Pena, respond if you would.
I think that that's why it's very important that we have a body like the ECFMG that can ascertain.
That's the certification
whether,
body.
Exactly. Again. The Educational Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates to ascertain whether the education that these individuals received is equivalent to that of a medical graduate in the United States. I absolutely agree with that. It's an imperative to have. If we're talking now about the scope of practice after medical school, that the person may be up to that or not, but we have not measured that particular set of skills. Granted, in other places, they don't have MRIs in every hospital room, and they may not have the latest and greatest in technology and medication, so there have to be some standards in place in the United States, for sure.
And Atul Grover, if you could wave a magic wand and do one thing that would improve the match between the need and the provider, what would that be?
The thing that needs to happen right away is for Congress to get rid of the freeze on support for residency training positions. It'll be a win-win for the American people and for foreign medical graduates who want to come here and take care of our communities.
And for some odd reason, that isn't what's being debated on Capitol Hill today. Atul Grover, thank you. We have to pause for a moment. As you know, this is a fundraising period for KQED, a public radio. For more information about how to support KQED, you can go to kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. And let's continue with a comment from Manny, who joins us in Cupertino. Manny.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A lot of our citizens are not able to get into medical schools. They can go into foreign medical schools, but they are unsure of getting the 1 or 2 year residency training that is required for licensing purposes. So my suggestion is let them finish the residency training overseas. They are still taking the USMLE 1, 2, and 3 exams. Allow them to take the board exams in primary care, whether it's internal medicine or pediatrics or whatever, wherever we have shortages. That way they get them the license, give them the license, require them to do the serve in underserved areas for a few years as condition of licensing. And this solution increases the number of doctors. There is no language issue involved. They are culturally aware. And not only that, there is no requirement for additional Medicare funding for residency training. And one other point is that this should be open only to U.S. citizens. Otherwise, you are going to have marriages for green card shams.
Hmm. Okay, so, Manny, thank you. Bill Kelly, what do you think of that idea?
Well, believe it or not, right now, with respect to individuals obtaining ECFMG certification in the most recent full year, 2012, close to 30% of the international medical graduates were already U.S. citizens who had elected to attend medical school abroad. So they're going through the regular process. They're obtaining the ECFMG certificate and applying for the match, et cetera. And I think if I'm in last year's matching program for residency programs, a little over 2,700 of the successful participants were U.S. citizens who had attended medical school abroad.
Manny, thanks for the observation. Dr. Fernandez-Pena, what is your magic wand? We heard Atul Grover suggest that really the heart of this, whether it's foreign-trained doctors or domestically trained physicians, the bottleneck that has to be unplugged is at the residency level. Is that your sort of primary focus as well?
It's not the primary focus of our work because, as I said, we do not only work with physicians. So my magic wand would be that we develop as a country first an understanding that individuals that were trained abroad are actually capable of working in our workforce here. That would be the first part. Then I would hope that we develop a logical process of assessing competencies at the level where they need to be assessed to facilitate the professional integration of these individuals according to a set of standards. Somebody asked earlier about what's being done in Europe, the Bologna Protocol that the EU started a number of years ago.
Oh, right. We didn't get to William's part of that.
It's a homologation of licensing standards across the 20-whatever many countries are in the Union now. So when there's a free flow of trade of goods, there's also a free flow of people. They can, an Irish nurse can practice in Italy, and a German doctor can practice in Spain. So we have not looked at that from a more global perspective, and I think that would be a wonderful thing to study.
And Dr. Falurian, let me come back to you and ask you the same magic wand question. I think I know what your answer might be, but tell me.
Yeah, as I said, after increasing the number of residency positions, I like that the way that the American society, as you noticed in some of the listeners, look at the foreign trade graduates, they just mostly look at them just as some foreigners. But that's not true. If for example, my primary care physician cannot understand me, it doesn't represent all the international medical graduates. Mm. You just have to simply change your physician, you know. It may be just maximum 10%. I can't say just maximum, but I'm sure it's not more than 5% of the foreign graduates. That, like everybody else or in every other position in this country, if you are accept people come to here as an immigrant, you should be able to accept them to solve in this society. You know what I mean? You should give them room and make facilitate for them. For example, to accepting them into a physician assistant program. Nobody is talking about just going out there and start practicing medicine without any training. We're all talking about being trained in as a resident or in a physician assistant program or something like that. For example, in right now, there are some institutes that have an intense course for an entry-level master program for nursing, right? So everybody that has a bachelor, even if it's not in a nursing, and the person never has been a nurse, can get that license in 1 year intern course, and then after that start to work as a nurse.
And I must hold you there. I wish you all the best of luck. We take your point about if you are in this country and have abilities to serve, there ought to be a way to provide them. And we wish you the best of luck in finding that match in the years ahead for you. I want to thank our other guests as well. Bill Kelly joining us from the Educational Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates, Atul Grover from the Association of American Medical Colleges, and Jose Fernandez-Pena, the associate professor at San Francisco State who runs the Welcome Back Initiative. Thanks all very much for being part of our program. And this is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.